Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Montag, lieben Klausen Globen.
All right. I got something to say.
First round of interviews for a while, so I'm already losing my voice. But I don't have to sing for a while, so I don't care.
One, two, one, two. First time I met you, we did one of these. We've done two of these before. We did one in 2017 and 2019, I think. 2017, you were saying that you'd actually stopped drinking. How's that going for you, Joe?
Fucking liar. Maybe I would probably stop drinking at the time I was talking to you, as in...
You're just on a break.
I was on a break, you know. I mean, I do that. I'll go 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks without drinking because I don't drink for the sake of it. I drink if I want one, you know, a glass of wine with a wife or, you know, a shot of whiskey with a friend or whatever, you know. But I was probably just having one of those. I'm coming off because I can. I just turn it on and off. It's like watch Marvel films for 6 months. And then I don't watch one for 3 years.
And then
years.
You're like, you know what? I've had my fill there.
Done.
I've had my fill. And then the second time we met was December 2019, which was just a couple of months before you
COVID.
Know what happened. Mm. How did you spend your time, Joe Elliott, in the lockdowns? What did you do to stay busy?
It was probably the most productive time this century, in fairness. A different way, but needs must, really. You know, you have to isolate. I'm at home, and what's in my home? My studio, my archives, my tape library. And at some point, I said, you know, I'm going to go in there and sort it out. And I've got this box full of cassettes that there's nothing even written on them. So one by one, you shove them in the machine, hit play and see what's on it. And you oh, wow, really? They write down what it is. And so that's how the bonus material off the Pyromania 40 box, half of that is, I wouldn't have found it without lockdown.
Right.
So yeah, it killed a lot of granddads and grandmas. But if you isolated, I found it a very productive time. We wrote and recorded Diamond Star Halos independently of each other, like in three different countries, and made it, glued it together to sound like it'd been recorded in Abbey Road. And so we learned a lot about, hey, we can do this, we can record without having to go somewhere away from our homes or drag them to my studio so they have to be away from home and I've got people in every bedroom in the house.
Yeah.
We had so much fun doing Diamond Star Halos that I think we've actually sworn that that's going to be how we record from now on, because why do we need to be in the same room? We kind of write independently the way Queen used to do these days. So we trust each other. If somebody says, I've got this great song, they mean it. And they're probably right, you know, and we're happy to go that route. So we did so much stuff. Like I said, it was tidy up. You know, domestically, we were renovating until we weren't allowed to, but we were secretly doing it anyway. I was doing all the tidy up stuff of my tape library and writing, and we were recording and just enjoying life from a different perspective, because I could shut off, because I had to shut off. So, okay, well, the telly still works and Netflix still works and the garden's fine to be in. So if it's summertime, I'm going to be out there with the kids and we're going to have fun, and I'm going to use that trampoline instead of looking at it, you know?
Yeah. Well, so you've basically been on tour from the age of what, 16?
No, I was...
How old were you when Def Leppard really started?
Well, when we first... the first gigs we ever did, I was 18 years old, first right. gig we ever played. I was 19 until we signed the deal. I was just 20 when we signed the record deal. So I was 20 when we did Sammy Hagar and AC/DC. I had my 21st birthday opening for AC/DC in America. The only gig we've ever done with Brian Johnson. On my August the 1st, 1980.
Still to this day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find that shocking.
We did 3 weeks with the Bon Scott version.
Yeah.
One gig with AC/DC. We didn't need to open for AC/DC for a long time. So, and then it just never came back round again. I was 19, 18 when we started. So,
you've never been off the road, really?
46 years. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We actually, in fairness, other than when we're in the studio, the only year that we actively have not done anything was 2010, where I did the first Down and Outs album.
Yep.
And 2004, when we started piddling about with the covers album, yeah. And we took that year off because I was getting married. There was no point in touring. We'd done it up till 2003. We were getting a bit disillusioned with the way that the management were handling us. We ended up changing management in 2005, and then the covers album came out. So we were kind of messing around in 2004. Other than 4 and 10, we've pretty much toured in some area of the world pretty much every year.
So if
except
anything,
20
it was
21.
A welcome break. And then you obviously come out of lockdown. Everybody's chomping at the bit to get back to work, get back out on the road. You guys go out and do, am I right in presuming, probably the most successful tour you've ever done, the huge stadium tour you did over the course of a couple of years with Motley Crue. Mm-hmm. How many tickets did that tour do in total?
I have no idea.
Millions.
I think I read once about 1.4, 1.5 million tickets. I'm really not sure. And that didn't include South America, which came last year. 2022 was huge. In 20, when we put it on sale, when we had to cancel, we were at about 94% sold. But, you know, it was a few months before we were due to go out. When it went back on sale, when it was re-announced, and we gave people the opportunity to sell their tickets back, but we'd hold them and they could buy them back again. We were at 97% by the time we actually went out in 2022, because I think there's just a craving to see a band in and touch people and see them again without wearing a mask, you know.
For sure.
It was huge. It was great, you know. And it was, you know, wasn't without its, like, hiccups. I mean, you've probably seen the photographs from Atlanta the first night. It absolutely lashed. I think 9 out of 9, it rained on at least one of the bands at the first 9 shows. And you can't hide because you're in a stadium, you know.
Yeah.
Don't close the roof, you know. So it's not like Wimbledon. So it was, you know, there was issues to hurdles to jump. But musically, we were on fire. We had the new album. We were playing 25% of the set was a new record. So we were making a point, like, we're not here for a nostalgia trip. We're promoting Diamond Star Halos, which we'd made through, you know, made it in 90. We've pretty much finished it early 21. And we said, we're not releasing this in a pandemic. We're not going to do what we'd seen other bands do, where they can't promote the thing.
Why?
So we held on to it. And while we were holding on to it and getting it ready for the following year, Universal, who'd taken up the option to put the album out, suggested, why don't you do a classical album on Decca Records with, you know, the London Philharmonic? And we went, okay, we've got this year now, we're not touring again in 21. So we could drip feed. So by the time we released, when we went over to do promo in 22 to make the videos for Fire It Up and Kick, we went to Abbey Road to record the strings during that week we were there. So we had the album kind of ready to mix. We just released Diamond Star Halos, and now we're sitting on Drastic Symphonies. So we know that's coming out in a year's time. So we're putting two records out, and lo and behold, Drastic Symphonies actually charted higher than Diamond Star Halos did. And, you know, doing the new version of Sugar with them, and, it, you know, then we did the BBC Piano Rooms, which is really big for us, doing Life on Mars and stuff. We were just in a really good place, because that 2 years away, we didn't sit there going, oh, okay. We were, okay, what can we do? When we first, the lockdown thing happened in March, they were literally a day away from flying over to my house to work for a month to see what we had. We weren't going to get a record done, but we'd get some demos done. And then come April, early May, we're going to go into rehearsals for this tour starting in June. But by the time March comes along, we know underneath the radar, this tour's not happening because this thing's getting worse. So it's like, I got on the phone to Phil and said, okay, now what? Why don't we try doing it over the internet? Make an album over the internet. So we got on to Ronan, our engineer. He says, yeah, it's easy. It's actually dead easy. He glued it all together in this thing called Bounce Boss. He sent all the stems out. Phil records his guitars, sends them to Ronan. They come up on the desk as though he's recorded the guitars in the next room. Same with the vocals.
For a band like you guys, that method suits your style.
Dead easy. It's exactly the same principle as how we made every record. Mm. One guy goes in and does his sing while the other four are playing pinball. And then the next guy comes in. We don't do it like you see it in the movies. That doesn't. Most people don't. Trevor Horn never did that. Didn't do it. Maybe with AC/DC, but a lot of the other stuff he did, he brings in musicians separately to get the perfect performance. So that's how we've always done it, but we've always been in the same building. This time we weren't even on the same continents. But it was easy, and it was relaxed, and there was no end game. There was no, it's got to be finished by April. No, it doesn't. It has to be finished. We don't even have a record deal. Only when the album was finished did Universal got the catalogue say, yeah, we want to put it out. So we could go into negotiations with this finished record that they could hear and have no influence on, because it's like, look, we are our own A&R man. So if you don't hear a single, there isn't one, but we know that there's like three, because that's what we do. We write pop rock songs, you know. So we use our time really well during lockdown.
And coming out the gate firing with a tour like that as well, I remember watching it unfold from this side of the pond, being very jealous of the people getting to see it, because the bill as well.
Yeah.
You had Joan Jett and Poison.
I mean, she's in the Hall of Fame, for God's sake. And she went on at 6 o'clock at night for an hour, you know. She was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, and Bret Michaels is a fantastic showman for getting a crowd going. And then you've got, you've got us and Motley, which is just like, theirs is, it's all about the show. With us, it's a little bit less about the show, more about the songs. But it doesn't matter. They complement each other really well. Bands, we got on great with them. I mean, me and Nicky have known each other, well, since the 80s, but...
I was going to ask, how far back does that relationship go? Did you know each other in your peak?
We knew each other a bit.
Naughty years.
Yeah, we did know each other a bit. But we got to know each other more between times. Like in the early, he used to have his own radio show and I'd go in and do it. And
Sixth Sense, yeah.
Yeah, we'd you know, promoting the Down and Out stuff, I'd go in and we'd talk about Mox, a huge fan. And, you know, not a lot of people know that when Mott the Hoople split and they carried on as Mott, Nigel Benjamin, the singer from Mott, went over to LA and was Nicky's singer in London.
Right.
So they had all this kind of gossipy stuff to talk about as well. And, you know, once you exchange emails, you're just buddies for life then, aren't you? And me and Nicky hung out a lot on the tour. You know, we're always in and out of each other's dressing rooms, you know. You're putting your slap on, can I come in for a minute, you know?
Hey, Joe, there's two things I want to ask you about that tour. One of them is ridiculous and wild and funny, and the other is heartwarming and beautiful and really emotional. We'll go with the ridiculous and absurd one first. The day that Tommy Lee decides to share a certain photo.
Oh, right, yeah.
On Instagram. Mm-hmm. Where are you and the rest of Def Leppard when that photo is posted? And what is your immediate thought?
Well, I don't do social media as an individual. We collectively, I do it every day because Ryan, our guy, comes in with a camera and says, all right, do something, you know. I think I was probably in the dressing room warming up and somebody went, you know, said, this is a phone. No, wait, this is a phone. Have you seen this? Right. Holy God! don't get much of that to a pound, you know. Bloody hell. I mean, we'd heard the legend, but I've never seen it, you know. So, you know, it's just some amusing thing. And then, of course, you'd see Tom in the corridor, and he'd be all sheepish, like going, oh, sorry, guys. You look at him going, really? Wow, congratulations, you know.
Because with something like that, we're in a very different time now to the 80s. Did that threaten to derail the tour at all? Or was it just another case of Tommy being Tommy?
It wasn't going to derail our part of it. You know, of course, it gets, in the media, like everything else, it gets a negative twist. And you always know that the ones that shout naughtiest get the front page and everybody else is just doesn't give a shit. It's underneath the radar. You know, most people sniggered at it.
Mm.
And there's always somebody that's, you know, got a bee in their bonnet about something that's going to make a hullabaloo about it, and that would become the headline. So I think, as we've always said, it's like bad reviews. You read them on Saturday, it's fish and chip paper on Sunday, and you wipe your arse on it on Monday. You know, it's gone by Tuesday, you know. So I think in this day and age, what Tommy did was so Tommy.
Yeah.
And there were probably a million people did the same thing that day. It just didn't get picked up, you know.
Because they don't have 2 million followers or whatever.
Yeah, you know.
So the other one I wanted to ask you about, and this I only recently learned, I saw a clip of a Swedish radio station interviewing Michael Monroe, and it really warmed my heart. So Michael was talking about how he'd emailed you when you were out in Finland at a festival with Motley, and he'd asked if you wouldn't mind putting in a word and seeing if he could come and meet Nicky and obviously Vince.
Yeah.
And just make right that, you know, trauma from the past, because in all these years they've never had the chance to actually sit down and talk about it. And,
right.
And he said that it was because of an email he'd sent to you that he was able to do that.
Yeah, it was me doing my Henry Kissinger bit, I suppose. He said, I've never met Vince. In all this time, he'd never met him. And he wanted to put all the supposed bad blood behind him, you know. So I just took Nicky to one side and said, listen, tell me to off, but you know, I've just had an email from Michael and he really wants to come and say I'm okay with this, I'm at peace with this, you know, no hard feelings or whatever. And I didn't get involved, I wasn't there when it was happening. I mean, I did kind of towards the end, I think we might have had a picture taken, I can't remember, but I let them have their an hour together, whatever. And I remember Nicky coming out going, that was beautiful, that was great, you know, him and Vince were totally fine. I didn't see that bit, so I could only speculate on what was said and how they reacted to each other. But what I was told from Nicky was like, that was a good thing, because Vince could then probably put it up behind him as well.
Yeah. Yeah, really important healing moment for both of them.
I would hope so.
I'm sure. I got to see you at Copenhagen last summer, and I thought you guys were on for like just the best I'd ever seen you.
Right.
I've seen you probably seven times, I think, over the years. First Download 2011 was the first time.
The cold one, yeah.
Then I saw you 2012 with the Motley Crue package tour again then. Mm-hmm. A couple of times in the intermission between the 10 years of then and now. But Copenhagen last summer, just the production, the sound, the quality of the stage show, the whole package. It was just incredible.
Yeah. Well, we work very hard to be that band, you know, that band that doesn't use tapes, as we've recently been accused.
Who was it? Chuck Billy? Testament.
Yeah, couldn't remember his bloody name. And the guy from Chris Holmes that used to be in Wasp, same thing. It's like, no, dude, it's not. Yeah, the beginning bit of Love Bites, Sav plays it on a keyboard the way Geddy Lee plays bass pedals. Rick uses a drum loop on Rocket. I mean, Christ, a two-arm drummer couldn't play that. But every word is sung. Every guitar chord is played. We don't cheat. You know, there's not one word on tape. There is, you know what I mean? There's nothing. We've got some keyboard sounds that sound like don't know, oohs and ahs maybe, but they're just keyboards. They're not even supposed to be vocal. They're just keyboards that Sav plays with his foot.
Yeah.
You know, we use, if we're doing excitable, we use the, are you excitable?
Yeah.
Thing. Yeah, because it's an intro tape. If we're doing, beginning of the show, take what you want. We play the beginning bit off the record and come in because, you know, it's an intro tape intro, you know, so of course we're going to do that. But, you know, we've worked really hard to be able to sing live as well as we can. It's not perfect. It's not supposed to be. If we're running at 90%, we're doing good. And long may they keep accusing us. I really don't care.
Well, it shows that they can't believe it's live because it sounds so good, right?
You know,
so
maybe everybody else's standards are less than ours. I don't know. Listen, when I've got a sore throat, I sound like shit. If somebody cuts their finger open slicing an orange, they're going to play a bit bad if it's that hand that they've cut, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yeah.
It happens. Sometimes Phil will come off stage, he goes, bloody hell, I sound like I had boxing gloves on. But it's like nobody else except him would notice that, you know? I mean, everybody has a bad day, but if the other four are on fire, one of us can be a bit under par and it still works. It's normally focused on the singer, who's terrible, yeah. Band were great. But I've been good this last couple of years. You know, I might have had the odd gig where just scheduling just whacks you out, or you catch a cold, or you can play the drums with COVID. You can't sing with it. You know what I mean? So you have to do something to get yourself into that position you have to be in by 9 o'clock. Even if it means warming up for 10 hours to get on stage to do it, that's what I'm prepared to do. Maybe other people aren't prepared to do that.
Dude, I think you sound as good as you've ever done, and it's a testament to your work ethic. But I think another thing that's worth mentioning, and you know, sorry if you get asked about this all the time, but you mentioned a drummer not being on full form. I saw you at Download 2011 for the first time, which I gather was the place where you first played again as a band with Rick after his accident, like Big Show. And the response that the crowd gave him after what you said in that moment was so powerfully beautiful. I gather the place, you know, Donington must harbor a number of special memories for you guys as a band.
It does, but apparently you missed out on the big one because I didn't even know it myself. But when we played in 2009, apparently my introduction was 11 minutes long. I'm like, really? Wow, I really can talk. You know, it's this mad thing about, you know, this is a spiritual kind of homecoming for him because the first gig was, well, I think the stage was in a slightly different place, but it was Monsters of Rock in 86, and we were way down the bill. It was Ozzy, Scorpions. Oh, it was us and then Motorhead and then Bad News, I think.
Amazing.
And then, of course, it was 23 years before we would play it again, you know. And, yeah, I mean, it needed to be said. And I'm sure I tried to do it again 2 years later without repeating myself, if you like, you know. But, yeah, I mean, it is a special place in that respect, and it always will be, because when you've gone through the trauma that he went through, and then you make your – we did do 5 warm-up shows in Ireland, but you make your real proper entry back into the world of rock under those circumstances in front of that many people. And bear in mind, this is after an album that didn't sell in England, so we're between Pyromania and Hysteria coming out, but Hysteria was a year away from being released. We were very well received, better than we've ever been received, even with a top 20 album with On Through the Night. We were really well received. I think there was a lot of respect. It was got nothing to do with the music. It was down to the humanity of the band and the willpower of Rick, you know.
Well, it's a testament to the loyalty within the group, because so many other bands in that situation, because everything's just exploded for you, right? Like Pyromania's been out a year or so maybe. Everything's kicking off and you've had more momentum behind you than ever before. And then bang, that happens. And so many other bands in that situation would have gone, hey, we got to keep rolling. I'm sorry. Call us when you're ready. But you guys were like, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We're going to wait.
We were in Holland when it happened and we all went back to we were in Holland. We took a Christmas break and then it was happening on New Year's Day morning. Over New Year, anyway. I mean, it's one of them traumatic things where I can't remember the exact date because I kind of try not to. But anyway, I had my parents with me at my house and 10 to 1 in the afternoon, Peter Mensch phoned and he said, are you sat down? And you know when somebody says that, somebody's died. Mm-hmm. Well, this actually appeared to be something worse than that, because death at least is a finality. And this was like, well, now what? Because, well, he's a drummer, he's lost an arm. Your instant thoughts are, well, that's it then, he's done. But then, of course, as the weeks go by, and when he does say, I can keep doing this, and we're like going, yeah, it's the drugs talking, you start going, well, why can't he? You know, and Mutt Lange was really a pivotal person in this whole, yes, he can. And, you know, if you get a specially designed drum kit, you can do this. And so luckily for us, even though we'd worked with Steinman and it was a disaster, and then we started working with Nigel Green, who was Mutt's engineer, and that was a much improved situation. We had 7 drum tracks down on tape. So we didn't need him there because we had all these overdubs to do on those songs, which eventually wouldn't make the record anyway. But it gave us a focus while he was healing, and he was supposed to be in hospital for 6 months. He checked himself out after 6 weeks, went back to his, against the doctor's orders, but they couldn't stop him. Went back to his mom and dad's house for 2 weeks and got bored, and then came out of Holland just to be around the band. And then relearn. He had this kit made, they shipped it over to Holland, locked himself in a room for months and months and months, learning to play again, you know, while we carried on trying to make a bloody record, you know. It was a weird situation, but something about a band, you can circle the wagons, and all of a sudden, if everyone's got their back to each other, you can't break this circle, you know. So we were, and it was pre-internet and all that kind of stuff, so we were isolated like hell out in Holland. It was like being in the middle of nowhere. In Holland.
By some windmills,
and
right?
Also, yeah. The downside of it would be that we had no idea that Bon Jovi and Poison and Motley Crue were taking the spot we'd vacated when we left America in 83. So we had to start again, you know, and Hysteria took its time, but it got there in the end. But it was definitely a strange time, you know. When I look back at it now, you do wonder, how the hell did we get through that? But youthful enthusiasm and stubbornness, combination of the two, I suppose.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What is the secret to the longevity of your band in terms of not just how long you've been around, but how long since 1992 you've not changed any members? And if you hadn't have lost Steve, maybe he would still be with you as well. And it seems like you're one of the very few massive bands that has kept it, you know, the same members, the same guys, the same vision. You haven't fallen out. There's been no, you know, ego or greed or pride or these things derailing the thing. How have you managed to weather the storm together as a group?
Well, if there was an answer to that that was simple, you'd be able to bottle it and sell it, wouldn't you? It's chemistry, which you can't make up. That's individual. 5 different people would maybe last longer than us or not as long, depending who it is, you know. I never thought I'd see U2 with a different lineup, but we just did. You know, I mean, the Rolling Stones are now 3, you know. Duran Duran are slightly different. I think Simple Minds are only two of the original. The Who were only two. In fact, people call them the Two. You know,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but it's the music that wins it over. But I don't know. I jokingly always say fear of going back to the factory that keeps you going.
Well, must be a lot in that, no?
I jokingly say that, and I suppose it is always hovering on one of my shoulders. But the thing is for me is, like, I genuinely like to think, even if it's never going to pan out, we've yet to write our best song. I still think we can write a better song than whichever you think is our best song. Because I thought some of the stuff on Diamond Star Halos and the previous album, Def Leppard, was some of the best work we've ever done. I think the songs on Def Leppard and on Diamond Star Halos that are eons better than some of the stuff on Pyromania and some of the stuff on Hysteria. Not all of it, but they were great collectives. And I think that we proved that we can still write great songs with those two records. And more so with Diamonds Are Halos, it was the way it was put together is such an important dynamic of that record, of like nothing can stop us going forward. Even a pandemic is not going to stop us making what we consider to be a great album, you know? So I think it's just we enjoy each other's company and we enjoy the challenge of being a better band now than we were 40 years ago. Being good songwriters as individuals that can bring them to the table and the other guys go, brilliant song, nothing needs changing, it's great. Or being brave enough to say, I've got half a song, I need somebody to finish this off because I've just exhausted myself thinking of the next section. And Sav will go, well, I've got a bit of glue on the end of that. Well, that's exactly what I meant, you know, which is how we used to work on Pyromania and Hysteria. So we still do that. You look at the writing credits. Sav wrote the music for Take What You Want, and he says, I haven't got any words, but I've got this idea for the title. And I just wrote the chorus, and he said, yeah, that's great. I said, all right, do you want me to do the lyrics or do you want to do it? He goes, take it. So I wrote the lyrics. So Savage Elliot, once again, you know. I wrote three, Phil wrote three or four, and then me and Phil wrote six or seven. And he'd send me the music and I'd write the lyrics. And sometimes he'd have a chorus written. So it was dead easy for me to get into that headspace going, okay, I think it's about, I'll write the lyrics. I'll do a demo of it on my laptop, send it to Phil, go, what do you think of that? I go, fucking great. And then, okay, then I'll do a real vocal, you know. I insisted when we first chose the songs that, look, he says, well, we've got six. I said, no, we haven't. We've got seven. This guitar, that song you wrote in 2003, I've been dying for us to do it. He always came up halfway through Sparkle Lounge. It's not going to fit now. Came up halfway through Def Leppard. No, it's not going to fit. We're right at the beginning of this project. We're going to make this work. All right, I'll do a new demo for it. So he did. I sang my vocalist on the record on my laptop in a back bedroom of my house. And Alison Krauss sang to that. And then when I heard it, I went, I don't think I really need to sing this again. And they went, never thought you would anyway. It was a good performance, you know. So, I mean, the thought of me using a not so much a guide vocal, but a laptop vocal. And it actually, our sound guy is so good. Ronan McHugh's producer, so good at filtering out this, that, and the other, and making it sound like he did it in my proper studio. He says, as long as you've got a good microphone and you record it flat, it doesn't matter where we are. Abbey Road, Electric Ladyland, or your kitchen. It's all going to work as long as you're not in a tiled room with a bunch of echo. I just shut the curtains and got on with it, you know.
Songwriting for me is such a beautiful and like untangible thing, isn't it? As you say, you can have something, whether it's a riff, whether it's a melody, even just like a simple hook, that can not quite find its place within the overall tapestry of a song for years, but you always know in the back of your mind, one day,
yeah,
we need to get around to using that. And then somehow, some way, when the time is right.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the oldest one. At the time when it came out, the song was 2003, 2022. The song was 19 years old by the time it was released. It was 17 years old when we started, 18 years old when we started recording it. There's a song on Sparkle Lounge called Bad Actress, which I've always said it's the best song that AC/DC never recorded or wrote. I think I first started messing with that riff in 94. But again, it just didn't get finished, but his old riff always just stayed in my head. And it's strange because it's like not a singer riff. It's not like simple chord thing. It's like a proper, it's real AC/DC. But when I presented it to the guys in 2007 when we were recording, they were like going, oh, that's cool. I said, you've heard it before, you've just forgotten it. You know? But I finished it off, you know. So, you know, some songs when they get on the album are brand new, like Sugar was a last minute thing. Kick, we'd finished the album. It was 14 tracks finished. 6 weeks, done. And then Phil calls me, says, I've just written this song with a mate of mine called Dave Bassett. Not the Dave Bassett, the football manager. And oh, I send it over and he plays it. I went, you got to be kidding me. I said, this is us down to a T. Oh, you want to? I said, yeah, I don't give a shit if I've written the lyrics or not. It's a great song. It never bothered Roger Daltrey. Never bothered the members of Queen.
I love that.
You know, when Fred sings Tie Your Mother Down, which was written by Brian May. And all those millions of songs that were written by other people that Queen did. And I said, fine. So I sent it to Sav, and Sav was like, oh, yeah, we're on this. And then Vivian and Rick were like, yeah, great. You know, so, okay, we've got to do it quick. So we just played over the top of his demo and then took away some of the other bits. But we left some of it on. So you listen to it on headphones, there's some backing vocals that are all over the place because the original demo vocals. He said, sounds like the New York Dolls. I'm in. I want it to sound like the New York Dolls, you know, sloppy a bit, you know. Mm-hmm. It gives us a different thing where everybody thinks everything's staccato and machine-like with us. It's like, this is the furthest thing from that you'll ever hear us do since Iron Dry. It was just beautiful, but it was last-minute Larry, you know, as was Sugar, which was always the comparison we made. And then some songs, like I say, it might be 17 years in the making, you know, because you just have to find their spot. I think the Beatles did a song in their brief 8-year career, one after 909, which appeared on the White Album. I think they wrote it in 62, and they just never found a spot, but then it did, you know.
In terms of your fan base, something I noticed when I first saw you, and I've noticed to continue over the years, is there's a lot of young Def Leppard fans, a lot, way more than, you know, people might think. And I think that's because, like AC/DC, perhaps, you're one of those bands that's a staple at home for people growing up. So parents are switching their kids onto it, and then the kids become parents, and so on. Have you noticed through the years that young youth element has remained?
Well, you can't help but notice it because they're the ones that come down the front more than the oldies. They want to just sit at the back and enjoy the music, and they might stay sat down. They'll mostly stand up and they don't mosh. Actually, nobody moshes at a Def Leppard gig. They dance.
They sure dance.
But yeah, you see them because they're with our eyesight these days, pretty much all we can see. But, you know, the first 20 rows is a mixture of moms and dads, moms and daughters, dads and daughters, whatever. I remember going to see the Stones in, I think it was Toronto in 89. On the Steel Wheels tour, and Q Prime were managing the tour. And I was lucky enough to be able to get on the mixing desk because of my connections. And I remember looking off to the side and seeing this three people, 55-year-old dad, 30-year-old son, 10-year-old son, all singing Start Me Up, all singing Jumping Jack
Flash. Three generations, yeah.
And thinking, I really hope that happens to us one day. You know, and it has. You know, I think... But it will do for any. You can talk to Dave Garn from Depeche Mode. You can talk to Simon Le Bon. Talk to Bono. Talk to Jim Kerr. Anybody that's still in from that MTV era has been, you know, Bruce Dickinson. They'll say the same thing. They'll go, yeah, we've got dads, we've got granddads, and we've got kids, you know, because they've been around. So, of course, some people are going to stick. I mean, I've jokingly been saying, I can't wait to be a fly on the wall one day in a nursing home when the music that gets piped in to these old folks is Ace of Spades and Anarchy in the UK, not Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. It's coming, and it's coming in the next 5 years, you know, because there's going to be people in nursing homes that went to a Hawkwind gig or a Motorhead gig, you know.
That's just a beautiful thought.
Yeah,
isn't
it's
it?
A fantastic thought. If I'm ever in a nursing home, that's what I want piped in. I want UFO, Thin Lizzy, AC/DC, and Mott the Hoople and Bowie, T-Rex. You know, I don't want though. I mean, I'll listen to Sinatra, but I don't want to go out on Sinatra.
It's not the stuff you came up in, so you don't want to go out on it. Yeah,
that's for them on the balcony with a cigar and a glass of wine. You know.
Hey, let me talk to you about Taylor Swift and Miley Cyrus. The young fan base is already there, we've established. But when you have people like that pointing the attention of their fan base on a band like you guys, do you notice an influx of young pop fans discovering Def Leppard and getting switched on to you guys? And how do those two connections come about as well? I'd love to hear a little bit about how.
Well, as far as I'm aware, it's quite simply that Taylor was weaned on Def Leppard. She was, her mom was the fan, and she was in her womb throughout the Hysteria tour in 88.
Right.
So she got, she heard us before she was
born.
She
came out to it, yeah.
Yeah. And she kind of admitted to that. And then when she said in an interview that the only band she'd ever do Crossroad with was us, obviously people pick up on this and then they start making inquiries. Did she mean it? You know? Oh, yeah, absolutely. So a couple of months later, all the wheels are moving and we're doing this. She was 17 at the time.
Wow.
But look at her now. I mean, my God, you know, globally, she's got to be the biggest thing that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, bigger than the Beatles and the Stones combined is what somebody has been saying for the last two or three days. It's crazy, you know, and I think it's fantastic and it's well earned because she works her ass off.
And it's on her own terms, it seems like, from a business point of view as well, which totally is super inspirational.
If she, you know, collaborates, it's on her terms with, she's not told to do it by some A&R man. She does this herself. You know, that's pretty obvious. Miley, another big fan. When we did the Taylor Hawkins tribute show and we went into rehearsals, it was fangirl stuff, you know. I mean, she was really cool about it. I mean, she wasn't like fawning, but she wasn't just, oh, somebody told me to do this. She knows our work. And like, we knew hers, you know. I mean, it was hard to get the twerking thing out of your head for the first 5 minutes, but you know, she was cool. She was great, you know. She wanted us to do a show for New Year's, but I just couldn't commit to it because I had family commitments I'd already set my heart on months before. But I've no doubt that we'll work together again one day because there was a chemistry there when we did the rehearsals. We sat around afterwards. We'd done our finished our performance, and before we did our performance, watching the other bands on the screen and just talking and just, you know, it was like we'd known her forever. There was a connection through music more than anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think some of her fans will acknowledge her respect for us, but I don't think they go running out to buy tons of our records. But I think it's a bit like that, having a certain respect for some of your parents' music, if you like, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a little easier these days because I think Def Leppard to a Miley Cyrus fan or a Taylor Swift fan is a bit more palatable than the Sex Pistols were to Frank Sinatra. You know, you know, anybody that likes the Pistols is hardly likely to say, oh, let's listen to some Matt Monroe, you know. But I think it's moved, like I said, it's like the nursing home thing. Older people, the music, I'm not saying that music has stagnated, but it's sealing down to a point. The only way that music really changes now is through sonics rather than songwriting. Songwriting has always been a thing. But AC/DC can write a song now that sounds exactly the same as an AC/DC song in 1978. It'll just be different production.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's really just another AC/DC song. They're going to be a great one, maybe, but they're of a certain ilk. And if Queen was still going, it would be the same kind of thing. There'd be the Brian Rockers, there'd be the Bowie-ish kind of Roger Taylor stuff, and there'd be the operatic Fred stuff, because that's what they do. And it's the same with us. We don't particularly want to change the wheels on the car because they work, you know, it's not broken. But at the same time, we've branched out. We do the piano, we do strings, we don't just do rock. We do as much as rock as we want. And if there's something where I come in with a song that sounds like Life on Mars, they don't react negatively to it the way we would have done 15, 20 years ago. So you can't do that. Yeah, we can. And everybody's on board with that, no matter what it is, you know. Phil says, I've written a song on a mandolin. Or a ukulele, that's it. I've written a song on a ukulele. Of course, after this digging, what is it, like when I'm cleaning windows part two, yeah, you know? And then he plays it, and it's actually, Phil, it sounds more like Led Zeppelin 3. So this is cool. And we used it, and it was You Rock Me, you know? We came out with this great tune that he wrote, and, it was a no-brainer for Diamond Star Halos.
I think the amazing thing about you guys is you've always had that pop sensibility and never been afraid to just focus on the songwriting and write great songs. And it seems like looking back through your whole story, early on when you got really big success in America, a lot of the British press are like, these guys have sold out. And it's like, if you're getting called sellouts from the start and it works, you might as well just keep doing what you're doing.
it might have bothered us for a little while, but we were lucky that when we started seeing the negativity, we actually weren't in England. So it was coming to us a week late, secondhand news. Oh, we got a sold out show tonight. So yeah, we've totally sold out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how we would treat it. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Looking for the silver lining in every dark cloud is what we did, you know. You know, it's been said quite a lot about the negative reaction we got at Reading Festival. Yeah, from about 5, 10% of the crowd, the rest of them were into it, you know. Like I said, you listen to live broadcast, BBC don't fake audience reaction. They don't overdub it in if there's none there. Yeah, we got some negative stuff. Every band got stuff thrown at them.
Well, that was that time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Throw piss at them.
It went away. It went away. By the time 87 came around, those people were, by their little brothers and sisters were into us instead. So it moved on, you know. It's fine. It's part of the journey. Loads of other bands have gone through fame going away and then coming back again, you know. Do something. Look at Lennon when he said they were bigger than Jesus. Everybody burnt their records.
Mm-hmm.
6 weeks later, they bought them again when he apologized. You know, I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous sometimes what gets written, but you know, it's all part of our journey. There's nothing that we'd particularly change. If that had been different, where we are now might have been different. So maybe all that, you know, Rick's accident, Steve's death, that's propelled us to a point with willpower and the guts or just the humanity to keep going. Or maybe it's just because we love writing songs and we like hanging out. And we've got a great Python, Fawlty Towers-esque humour that gets us through all the dark times, you know. And we always find a way to walk out of a situation that's been terrible and go, I thought that went pretty well. You know, and everybody will burst out laughing, you know.
Humour goes a long way.
It does. You know, it's the big bailout for me. It's you've got to have a sense of humour. You'd never get through this business without one because there's so much stupidity in it that you have to just sometimes bite your lip and go, I'm glad it's the five of us because we can just march through this nonsense and do what we do. And at the other end, people are either going to get it or they're not. But we don't really care because as long as we're happy, I think that that comes through as part of your armor. Mm-hmm. They go, well, they seem to be enjoying what they're doing. So maybe I've got it wrong, you know. And you eventually you might win the media over. Or as I like to say, the ones that were negative just died off. And then fans became journalists. And then it changes. Who knows how it works, you know. I don't study it like a professor or a student, you know.
For me, it's just one of the most inspiring stories in music. You know, you're such a successful band and having met you a few times, like, and met Phil a few times as well. The best thing for me is that despite all of the fame and success, you're so down to earth and just such humble, decent guys that are grateful for where they're at, still love doing what they do and are still making like the best music, you know, of their careers.
Well, we try. And I think that's the thing. We don't expect it. We're not given it. We have to go and earn it. And every time, you know, I've often said it's a bit like when you see the Dirty Harry trilogy of movies. At the end of the first film, Clint Eastwood saves the city. But by the beginning of the second film, he's back down at the bottom of the rung again because his boss hates him, even though he did a wonderful thing. And he's got to earn it all the way back till the credits run. And then for the third one, it's the same thing again. It's like, bloody hell, does he ever get a chance? Never gets a promotion, never gets a raise. And it's just, you know, you use that analogy as like, well, you know, okay, you're always as good as your last record. Absolutely true. The next one might be crap. It might sell, but then the next one won't because people will go, oh, yeah, you know, Emperor's New Clothes or whatever. You have to keep working and working and working. And I just think that working class attitude that we all have, because we come from working class backgrounds, drives you on because you don't want to go back there. You know, when your parents go, if you get the chance to get out of this, take it, you know. And that came from all of our parents. They were very supportive. My dad financially lent us 150 quid to make the first EP. He got it back because that was the terms and conditions of the deal. I'm loaning you this money. I'm not giving it to you. You learn nothing from winning all the time. You've got to lose a game to realize how you should win one. And all of us, you know, before we even knew each other, that's how our parents treat us. You want a guitar? Earn one. I'll loan you the money, but you're giving it me back through your paper round, you know, whatever, you know. And I think that's just sticks with you. And if they were honest, I think all the bands out of the 60s that came up through, you know, Terrace House, you know, lower working class or whatever, the Stones, the Kinks, the Who, they would say the same thing. They might dress it up more artily than I do. But I think that you'd get the same things. Like, they just don't want to go back there, you know.
Amen. More power to you, Joe Elliott. It's been a pleasure, as it always is. And I'll see you hopefully if I'm out there, this massive tour you're doing in America with Journey, Steve Miller.
Yeah, and occasionally Heart.
Heart.
And Cheap Trick.
And Cheap Trick is like the best bill I've ever seen. So, yeah, I'm going to try and make it down to one of them.
Excellent. You're very welcome.
Cheers, mate.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.